Well, this is, we just finished what I think to be one of my favorite weeks of the year. And it's one of my favorite weeks of the year because it has one of the days that I think is just one of the funniest days that we celebrate, which is that of Groundhog Day, which in my opinion is like a top three made up holiday of the year. It's not like a real holiday, right? It's not like Christmas or the Super Bowl, but it has a special place in our hearts where we watch people go do ridiculous things like wear tuxedos and top hats and go yank a, you know, groundhog out of its hole and then stick its face on the ground and say, "Do you see your shadow?" Because somehow that's as accurate as any other weather report we've ever gotten in our lives. And in that, I just think it's like the funniest thing, but it also speaks so much to like this inner yearning. Because from that, we constantly have asked ourselves, how do we understand what it means to know the future? Like it even like spawned a movie, which is Bill Murray, and Bill Murray just has, he deserves all the screen time in the world. And for him to have this movie, which is all about what do you do if you know what the future is going to hold, speaks so deeply to this inner desire that each and every one of us have. And it's why I love that day. And it's why I think it is, I don't know, divine intervention or sorts or something like that, where we're talking about in this sermon series, understanding the future. Because we are in a series right now called Missio Dei, which is the mission of God, where we've been focusing on what is God's mission in the world, and then what does that mean for ourselves? And we've been talking about how the mission of God is that God is trying to actively remove any and all barriers which would otherwise create separation from us, and that in eliminating those, it brings us back into right relationship with God. This is God's mission. But in the very first week that we talked about this, I made this distinction that we have to understand the difference between mission and vision. That a mission statement is one thing and it is separate and distinct from a vision or a vision statement for an organization. Because a mission statement, like I said, it's all about who you are. What is your purpose? What do you do? Your vision is the future. Where are you trying to go? One great way that this is described is, what will things look like if you accomplish your mission? How will things look different? And it should be clear. It should be defined. It should be lofty. It should be challenging. And it should push you towards some end goal. Microsoft had a vision statement back in the 1980s that was that there would be a computer on every desk and in every home in the country. And I thought that's I love that vision statement in large part because at the time, the average computer cost adjusted for inflation was $4,600. And so like Bill Gates, how did you imagine that you're going to get a computer on every person's desk in the world? But in spite of that, they had this understanding of where they could go. And there were a lot of things that had to be accomplished for them to get there. And they didn't know how, but they knew that's where they needed to aim towards. Because there were things like people had to adjust to technology. Technology had to get cheaper. It had to get smaller. It had to constantly be innovated. It had to be adopted by the larger community and as to understand the need and the value for it. And all of these things had to line up to where over decades of time, eventually, right, like we have a computer on every desk in the world. They did not imagine that this is what it was going to be, but did we not get there? Visions are far less about understanding how and far more about understanding where and what. This is best defined by Stephen Covey. So Stephen Covey wrote The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And in The 7 Habits, he has a habit that is named as start with the end in mind. Now, I think it's very ironic and funny that that's the second one is start with the end in mind and not the first one. But in that, he makes it very clear that in order to understand what you're trying to accomplish and where you're trying to go, you have to be able to start there so that you can start working your way backwards. And it also allows you to direct every single one of your actions towards that end goal, where you can self-audit. Today, I did X. Did X push me towards that end result? What I think that Stephen Covey maybe understands, maybe doesn't understand, is how deeply scriptural the mentality is of start with the end in mind. Because all of scripture and all of the mission of God is pointing us towards this end result. Because when you start with the actual end of scripture, looking at the very last chapter of the book of Revelation, you get this. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. No longer will there be any curse. The throne of God and the Lamb will be in the city, and his servants will serve him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. There will be no more night. They will not need the light of a lamp or the light of the sun, for the Lord God will give them light, and they will reign forever and ever. That's where we're headed. The joyous imagery of that. And Revelation is, like, Revelation's a wild book. And you've probably heard things about Revelation, and yeah, like, all the things you've probably heard about it are quasi-true. You've probably heard some stuff that isn't true. There is a dragon in Revelation, which I think is super cool. But it's not designed to be this end of times, doom and gloom, Armageddon type thing. But it is designed to talk to a people who are going through this struggle and explaining to them that in the midst of the struggles that they're going through, God is still present with them. More importantly, there is an end goal in sight that is good. Our biggest issue when it comes to understanding the end goal that is good is it's really difficult for us to grasp. It's really difficult for us to grasp something when everything about our experience, everything about our lives is the antithesis of that. I think about that idea in terms of premarital counseling. And the reason for that is that one of the things I love asking in premarital counseling is, hey, tell me a little bit about how you grew up. What was your parents' marriage like? And people give a lot of answers, but they basically fall into like one of two major categories effectively, right? Where you have one person who's like, no, I mean, my family was awesome. My parents kind of bickered here and there, but like they had a great, healthy marriage, right? And we had like a wonderful, amazing life. We were like the Beavers on Leave It to Beaver. We had a white picket fence and everything, right? Like our life was awesome. And then you have another category where people are like, we were basically on the Maury Povich show, right? And we were like we were a hot mess. And the thing about it is actually, if you understand where you come from, you realize that in reality, we're all a little bit of a hot mess and that our families are the reason why we're all a little bit of a hot mess. And that is actually okay. It's actually good. If you can understand where you came from, it gives you an opportunity to understand who you want to be. And I love asking that question because my favorite scenario, frankly, is when a person with the Beaver family and a person with the Maury family, like, marry, right? Because I love being able to look at them and say this very real thing, which is for you who had an amazing image of marriage growing up, you need to understand how much work your mom and dad truly put in to make that happen. It was not accidental. It is not just going to happen. And for those who've had a difficult childhood growing up, naming to them, you don't have to repeat that yourself. That just because your experience told you life is going to be this, does not mean that it is a guarantee that that will continue to happen. You have to put in work to either continue it or to move against it. And when we think about the end of times, we think about the vision of where God is pushing us towards in this great mission of transformation of the world, we have to grasp and understand that. That things can be made new and that they can be made good, even if we don't grasp it because we look around the world and we think it's awful. We think there's issues. We think there's struggle and trouble and strife. One of the ways that you can think about this is through the Chronicles of Narnia. C.S. Lewis wrote this series of books called The Chronicles of Narnia. It's about this imaginary, fantastical land called Narnia where Jesus is a lion, and it's like super awesome. And in that, it's this seven-book series that takes place over about 2,500 years, effectively, and they tried to turn it into a series of movies. If you've never read the books, I've got a couple of problems with the movies. The first is that they like stopped after three, and you can't stop after three. And the other is that they chose Liam Neeson to be the voice of Lion Jesus, and we all know that God is voiced by Morgan Freeman, and I'm not saying that's why the movies failed, but I do think that it's a contributing factor. And but in that, knowing that it takes like 2,500 years, it does play out this story in which you have like Aslan, who is the Jesus figure, who has this great resurrection moment in book two. And then you have all this time until you get to book seven, which is called The Last Battle. And in The Last Battle, they're all trying to figure out how to defeat evil and darkness that exists in Narnia. And then eventually Jesus comes in the form of the lion and he sets it right. And he invites everybody who's loyal to go be with him in a new Narnia. And he says, because the old Narnia has to pass away, we have to be in a new one. The old one is marred by evil and sin, but don't worry, we've made a new one, a real one, the one that you want to live in. Because C.S. Lewis deeply understood the idea of what God was trying to do. He understood what Revelation was trying to explain. And in this story, he gave an example of what it meant for us to continue to be a part of the story wherein the world would be healed. The hardest part of that, though, is the fact that like when you read those books or you look at Revelation or you look at our world around us, we can't actually do it. The world is not going to be healed through our actions, unfortunately. It would be awesome if we could just do it ourselves. But the reality is that it is not going to be made right until Jesus comes again. And that begs the question, right? Is does that mean that all of a sudden we can just hang around and do nothing? Is like Earth just a waiting room until Jesus comes back? The problem with that mentality is it flies in the face of the idea that when Jesus arrived, it says, behold, the kingdom of heaven has come near. The kingdom of heaven is among us. It means that there is opportunity to experience the kingdom of heaven today if we're willing to embrace it. So yes, even though the world is not going to be set right perfectly until Jesus comes, it does not mean that you and I have nothing to do and nothing to be a part of it. But when we live into the mission of God and we work to do what we can to heal the world, there are things that do actually get healed. And it gives us the opportunity to experience heaven. And more importantly, it gives others the opportunity to experience heaven as well. If we shift our mentality to asking what one thing can we do that will propel us forward towards that final ultimate vision, we realize that we start working for one, for ourselves. We start working for one, for our neighbor. We start working for one, a neighborhood or a community. If we work to end hunger in the world, which I believe in the kingdom of heaven, there's no hunger, right? If we work to end hunger in the world, there's a few scenarios. One, we might never actually truly end world hunger ourselves, but it does mean there are people who are hungry and we can help feed them. Two, we might actually one day end world hunger and that would be amazing. World hunger might come back into play even after we fixed it, but it doesn't change the good work that was done in the name of Christ. And even if world hunger never comes back into play after we've done all this work to fix it, there will be something else that comes in that mars the world because this world is broken and it will be until Jesus comes again. But if we embrace the fact that there is work for us to do that enables us to experience heaven now, that enables others to experience heaven now, we get a true glimpse of what glory can be. And this was Jesus's entire premise. It's everything that he was teaching. It's everything that he was about. One of the places you see this is actually in the book of Matthew, in the 20th chapter. We're going to read a passage of it here in a second. But in that entire chapter is kind of wild because it opens with a parable. And this particular parable is this one where there is a bunch of workers who are all hired to go work in this field. And one is hired in the morning, and then one is hired to come and continue the work a little bit later. One is hired to come a few hours later, and then one is hired just before closing for the day. And at the end of it, the guy who owns the field gives everybody an equal share. And then the person who was there since the beginning was like, this doesn't exactly seem fair. Do we not like all get compensated for the work that we individually did? And Jesus is trying to demonstrate this idea that when you understand the goal of where you're trying to go, when you understand the actual reward of heaven in the end of times, you realize it's not something that can be partitioned. It's not something that can be doled out according to work. It is an all or nothing thing. Everybody receives the goodness of that reward, or nobody. And so the idea is, what are you doing for it? And what do we have to do to ourselves to experience it? And immediately after this parable, there's this really funny moment that happens wherein this woman comes up to Jesus, and it says, then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and kneeling down asked a favor of him. What is it that you want? Jesus asked. She said, grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom. Basically elevating them to be like grand leaders within the kingdom of heaven. Jesus responds, you do not know what you are asking. He said to them, can you drink the cup I am going to drink? We can, they said. Jesus said to them, you will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those whom they have been prepared by my Father. When the 10 heard about this, the other 10 disciples, they were indignant with the two brothers because, you know, they were trying to, you know, they were trying to work around. And Jesus called them together and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be your slave. This is sometimes also translated, whoever wants to be first must be last. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. In the kingdom of heaven, those who are great are actually those who lower themselves. They are those who actively work to put others first, who actively work to make themselves last. But in order to get that, we have to have a true level of self-awareness. We have to recognize what are those things that we want so deeply in this world that are preventing us from truly embracing the servant's mentality that Christ had always asked us to have. This is another C.S. Lewis book called Great Divorce. It's one of Arthur's favorite books. He like did a podcast on it. He references that as much as the Bible, and it's like a tenth of the size of the Bible, but he says the Bible is still his favorite, but I think it's closer to 50-50. But in that, it's a story about all these people who've died. They are kind of like on the at the gates of heaven, effectively. They're at the bottom of this mountain. This mountain is heaven, and they're asking, "What do we have to do to get up there?" And they're being told, "You've got to give up something that is holding you back, and all you have to do is let it go. All you have to do is quit it." Like there's this artist who's like, "Well, I can't wait to get to heaven so that everybody can tell me how great my artistry is." And they're like, "That's not how that works." And he's like, "Well, aren't there like other great artists in there?" And they're like, "Yeah, there's like some amazing artists in heaven." And he was like, "Well, like, isn't everybody so excited to engage with them?" And they're like, "No, man, like they're the same as like the janitors. Like nobody cares." And this artist literally is like, no, I want to be recognized for my greatness. I'm out." And he quits. There's like a mom who is like, oh, I've got to protect my son. I've got to do this for them. I've got to do this for him. And I can't go to heaven because my son needs me. And it's a thing of being like, listen, your job is to worship God. And actually in doing so, you'll provide an example, but you are not letting yourself let go of this other person. You've actually created this like codependency instead of actually allowing them to flourish and yourself to flourish. And if you can't let that go, you will never actually be able to go into heaven. And it's story after story after story of people who are being challenged with the things of, are you willing to let it go? Because the greatest act of humility is being able to let go that which we tell ourselves we need, because we're trying to tell God what we need instead of listening to God, the one who made us, telling us what we need. And so the challenge for us this week is frankly to ask ourselves, how do we quit something? How do we let something go? Bob Goff is this very famous writer. He's like professor at Pepperdine Law. He has an office in Disney World. He's like he works for the consulate of Uganda. The dude has a Forrest Gump style life. He's got this crazy life with all these experiences. But he talks about how every single Thursday he quits something. Every single Thursday he quits something that prevents him from being the full image of a servant of Christ. So sometimes it's quitting an app on his phone. Sometimes it's just like quitting being angry or holding a grudge against somebody. One time he quit a board that he was a part of because the board met on Thursday nights and he didn't want to go anymore and it was a perfect excuse, right? But what can you quit this week? What can you pray about this week so that this Thursday you can quit something that you have told yourself you need or that you want, so that if giving it up allows you to take one step further for yourself and for others to experience the kingdom of heaven today? This is what this table actually represents.